Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Second hour, open forum, Catholic Answers Live. This hour, Jim Blackburn here with us. Jim Blackburn, longtime apologist here at Catholic Answers. And now, what do we call you, like a freelance apologist? Or what's your title there, Jim?
I'm just an apologist, author, speaker, and I'm on the Catholic Answers Speakers Bureau. I do a lot of writing for Catholic Answers, but I'm, maybe freelance might be a good way to put it.
Freelance or like freewheeling. Or barnstorming. I think barnstorming.
Barnstorming.
We'll call you the barnstorming apologist. 888-318-7884 is our number. Lines do fill up quickly when we're doing open forum, so please dial 888-318-7884. And open forum means any question you've got is welcome. We'd love to talk with you. There's no question too big or too small. We'd love to talk with you about the Catholic faith, and you do not have to be Catholic to call. Anyone is welcome to call. And Jim Blackburn, if I may begin with a question. Are you speaking anytime soon as the barnstorming apologist?
I don't have my calendar in front of me, so I wish I'd known you were going to ask that. I guess that kind of helps answer the question. I do not have any public speaking events coming up in the next month or so. I know that.
Okay.
I do some private events, you know, where I'll be invited to speak at an RCIA group or a ministry at a parish, things like that, that I can't invite other people to, but don't have any just public events like conferences or
nothing
open wide parish events, not during the summer. I think the next thing I've got coming up is in the fall, so it's a little while away. That means my schedule's open.
So call Jim Blackburn. Call the barnstorming apologist, Jim Blackburn.
Call me.
Absolutely. He will fly his single-engine open airplane into your town and apologize.
Just call Catholic Answers and ask for seminars department.
That seems like the easy way to do it.
Can book me, right through there.
All right. Well, let me just ask you this then. Since you're doing the RCIA thing, isn't it fun to go and talk with RCIA groups? Isn't that about the most fun you can have?
I do enjoy speaking with RCIA groups, especially when there are RCIA groups are adults typically. There might be some youngsters in there, but over seven. Most of the time, though, they are adults, and they are coming from another faith tradition. They might have been had some exposure to the Catholic faith, but now they're wanting to come into the church. And they usually just have this hunger for the faith, hunger to receive the Eucharist, to receive the sacraments, and this thirst for knowledge of what the church teaches. So I love it when we get together with a group like that. I always make sure if I'm speaking at an RCIA that I'm leaving lots of time for Q&A, much like what we do here on the radio.
Right.
Leaving plenty of time for these questions because the RCIA candidates typically do have just lots of questions, and I love to help with those.
Yeah, and there's a certain enthusiasm there and interest that – well, the other one is what's the one with beer? Theology on Tap.
Theology on Tap, yes.
You do those, I imagine.
I do. I think the last one of those I did was in Denver, Colorado, just before the election last fall. And those are a lot of fun too, especially if I don't drink too many beers beforehand. You know, I got to be careful of that.
Well, you're not so. It's not the beer's not for you.
Oh, it's not.
No, it's for the people that come to ask the questions. Oh. You're supposed to be alert and attentive. Were you drinking before this show, Jim? I just want to be clear something. What state are we dealing with you in?
Just water.
Okay.
Just water.
All right. Well, let's find out. Let's put that to the test. Kathy in Parkersburg, West Virginia, listening on the EWTN app. Your question for Jim Blackburn.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for calling.
So my question is about the event where Mary and Joseph took Jesus and presented him in the temple after he was born. So that's one of the joyful mysteries, but it's also one of the seven sorrows of Mary. So how can the same event be both joyful and sorrowful at the same time? And if it's just a matter of a different aspect of that event, what exactly are we supposed to be meditating on when we pray the joyful mysteries versus the meditating on the seven sorrows?
Okay. Now, I think it's Cassie. Is that right, Cassie?
Yeah, that's right.
I think you might be confusing the seven sorrowful mysteries, sorrows of Mary does not include the presentation of Jesus in the temple, but includes the losing of Jesus in the temple, really, which is kind of the opposite of the finding of Jesus in the temple, which is one of the joyful mysteries. To my knowledge, and I should look this up, the presentation of Jesus in the temple is a joyful mystery, but it's not one of the seven sorrows. So you might want to go back and look at those, but I think you might be conflating the two of those. The finding of Jesus in the temple is one of the joyful mysteries because Joseph and Mary had, after they realized Jesus was not with them, where is he? They go and they find him in the temple. Well, that first part where Mary and Joseph realize we've lost Jesus, we've lost our 12-year-old son, where is he? And we have to go back and find him. You can understand how that's a sorrow, the losing of Jesus in a sense. But then you can also understand the joy of finding him in the temple and see how that would be a joyful mystery. So does that help if you, if I'm in my right side, the seven sorrows does not actually include the presentation.
No.
Is that right?
That you are correct. And I'm not going to say that like I remembered them. I hate to pretend like I was just looking online and it's
okay. No,
yeah.
Okay. So Cassie, I hope that helps.
Yeah, no.
What's that, Cassie?
I said it has the prophecy of Simeon was one of the seven sorrows, which was the same event.
Oh, it follows. I see what you're saying. The prophecy of Simeon is what Cassie's saying, and which is Jesus is presented at the temple, and then the prophet Simeon says to Mary, "Your heart or your soul will be pierced by a sword."
Yes. Okay. I see what you're saying, and it's that prophecy. It's not the presentation of Jesus then that we're talking about here. It is the prophecy that Mary is, as I was just saying, that there's going to be much pain involved, you know, with the fact that what's going to happen with Jesus later on in his life, and Mary's own heart will be pierced. So that's again then the sorrow of what happens in that, and I can see how you're bringing these two together because it happens around the same event, but we're looking at two different aspects of the event. You know, one being the prophecy of sorrow, and the other one being the joy of the presentation of Jesus in the temple at 8 days old, and he's being presented to God, and this was a joyful thing that the Jews did, one of the requirements of the Mosaic Law. So you can see, I'm hoping then that we're looking at two different aspects of that event. Is that right, Cassie?
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, that helps. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Cassie, for that call. We'll probably take a quick break here, Jim, before you go, but I feel like if you're married, then you have an answer to that question, that how something can be both joyful and sorrowful at the same time.
Okay. Yes, I suppose you want to explain that further?
I thought that would make you laugh, Jim Blackburn, but it's hard to make you laugh. all right, we'll take a break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Don't you just love listening to Jim Blackburn? Did you know you can book Jim or any of our other great speakers to speak at your parish or special event? Contact one of our seminar coordinators through the Speakers Bureau section on Catholic.com today to find out more information.
Hi, this is Trent Horn, and I'm really excited to tell you about a special limited-time offer we've got right now on subscriptions of our award-winning Catholic Answers magazine. Sign up today during our annual subscription drive, and not only can you save big bucks off the normal price, you can get a collection of 5 exclusive audio presentations added to your order for free. Subscribe today at 818-487-2011 or online at catholic.com. Sign up for a 1-year subscription, and we'll give you $10 off the normal price. Better yet, yet, become a 2-year subscriber, and we'll up the ante by dropping the price $20 and sending you a customized Catholic Answers flash drive containing exclusive talks from a top-notch line of speakers, including Chris Check, Carla Broussard, Tim Staples, Cy Kellett, and my talk, Answering Atheism. That's a savings of $20 plus 5 brand new audio presentations when you sign up for a 2-year subscription to Catholic Answers Magazine. Act now. This is our best offer of the year, and it's only available for a limited time. Subscribe to Catholic Answers Magazine before our annual subscription drive ends. Phone 818-487-2011 or go to Catholic.com today.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, where I make jokes and Jim Blackburn doesn't laugh at them, and we're happy to take any call, any question you've got on the life, the faith, the history, the morals, the teachings, the traditions of the Catholic Church. And as I said, Jim Blackburn, barnstorming apologist, is our guest this hour. Jim, back to the phones. How about we go to Jason in Delaware, Ohio, listening to EWTN on 820 AM. Jason, your question for Jim Blackburn.
Thanks for having me on the show. I enjoy hearing the Catholic perspective on issues and theology and stuff. It's very, very enlightening and helping my greater knowledge of Catholicism. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
I just heard a disturbing thing on a Protestant radio show about this recent Pew Research poll. It says they did all religions in the United States. Catholics were found 67% okay with gay marriage. Evangelical Protestants we found to be the leaders, but it's poor as well. Both of us both know it should be 100% according to teaching, both from Catholic and biblical perspective. But even though we scored the highest, it still was abysmal 59% that were okay with gay marriage. And then I'm just going to do one quick comment, and then I can take my answers off the air. Quick comment on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Just real quick, number one, the council that met, the War Council for Japan, they met and they were discussing not surrendering after Hiroshima, but actually moving the Emperor Hirohito into Manchuria, where there was still a million plus Japanese soldiers to continue on the war. The military thought certain white outfits would keep them safe from this new type of bomb, and that it was just not a nuclear weapon, because some of their scientists proved 4 points scientifically. You can't have an atomic bomb. It's impossible. So,
Jason, before you take off there, Jason, thank you for your comments. But your question is concerning Catholics in support of so-called same-sex marriage or gay marriage. Is that what your question is about? And if so, what is your question exactly?
I can just let me finish this. Number two, civilians wounded or killed. Wounded or killed. They taught the civilians also to kill and wound at least one American with each person.
Jason, I appreciate that. It's just we discussed Jim. You probably didn't even know this, but in the last hour with Tim Staples, it came a question about Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the bombings there, and why Catholic moral teaching says that those were morally unacceptable acts. And. Mm-hmm. And so I think Jason is just responding to that and maybe wants to argue that the conditions made those morally acceptable acts because of the peril of the war. But Tim made the point at the time that the ends don't justify the means. We can never argue as Catholics that the ends justify the means. So what I'm going to ask you to do, I just want to let you know what that was about, Jim. But I would like you to address this. Basic question is, Jason is asking essentially, why do so many Catholics, more than 2/3 of Catholics, accept gay marriage?
Okay, and that's a certainly a legitimate question if indeed that poll is correct, and I've seen lots of different polls, but they do seem to be reflecting a more and more openness, even among Catholics and other Christians, toward this idea of that two men or two women can actually get married. And just because the law in our land says that they can, that doesn't make it true, doesn't make it something that actually happens. And of course, according to the teaching of Christianity, scriptural teaching, the sacred tradition of the church, this is something we know can never happen, and it's these types of relationships are always immoral. So we can never support them. So what do we make of the fact, if indeed this is true, that this particular poll found that 2/3 of Catholics do support that idea, then these are dissenting Catholics. At least objectively, they're dissenting from the teaching of the Church, from the authentic, from the truth, as well as from the teaching of the Church, which is consistent with that truth. It could be that this is also a reflection of the poor catechesis we have in the Catholic Church. In the last 50 years, well, since Vatican II at least, there has been a sad lack of authentic, true teaching and catechesis. And we have people, you know, my age today, Cy, and in your age, who are a product of this, who, you know, you and I probably didn't learn our faith as well as we know it today because we were catechized well growing up. That may be a different case with you. For me, it wasn't. I came to really fully embrace the truth of the Catholic faith and its teaching, even though I'm a cradle Catholic. I came to understand it as an adult and came to embrace the teaching of the Church, even the teachings that I found difficult, as an adult. And we have a lot of young people today and young adults today who are not as in tune with the teaching of the Church as they ought to be. And they even think, in many situations, that the Pope could change the Church's teaching on an issue like this. I give a talk on marriage, divorce, annulment, and various different aspects of, you know, what a true marriage is. And one of the things I point out in this talk is how marriage, correctly understood, is the coming together of one man and one woman for life to create a family. And you know, this is really what marriage is, what it's all about, regardless of a religious understanding of it. Even from a secular understanding of it, over the history of humanity, we understand this concept, this thing that happens in human society to promulgate our species, to create families and continue the existence of humanity. That's what marriage is. To now try to call other relationships marriage is an affront to marriage. It's offensive to marriage, and it's not what marriage is at all. So I think we need to, as a church, and this may have been a follow up Jason would have had. What should we do about it? I think we need to do two things. First, we need to catechize our children better, and our young adults, and our RCIA candidates. We need to catechize them better so that they do understand what the Church teaches on this. And number two, we need to, as Catholics, approach the secular arguments on this and the secular understanding of what marriage is, and make sure that people understand, even if we set the religious arguments aside, this is something so fundamental to humanity, we don't even need to bring the religious arguments into it. This is a fundamental aspect of the human race, and it's something that we need to embrace as reality, what marriage is, and not allow just the whims and desires of particular parts of our culture to try to change that. So I hope, if Jason is still listening, I hope that that's helpful, and I hope I got to what his real questions were.
I think you did that, and thank you very much, Jason, for that call. It's interesting that Tim's point was when he was addressing the atomic bomb question, was very much the same as your point, or part of your point there, which is some things are just true, morally true. And you if you don't accept that morality doesn't change based on the circumstances, then you have to be clear and consistent on these things. And killing innocents directly, intentionally, is always and everywhere wrong. And human sexuality is made for to be lived out in the context of family, in the context of the natural family. So these are consistent Catholic moral positions rooted in the idea that we don't just change morality based on what the latest trend is, or whether it's wartime, or some things are morally absolute.
That's right. There are intrinsic evils. And there are intrinsic truths, and we need to recognize those. And these are things that never change, regardless of the time, the culture, the circumstances. They don't change. And these are timeless truths. And as you mentioned, the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, some people might see that there came some good from that. It was an evil that was committed to begin with, and it's never okay to commit evil, even so that good may come of it. This is rooted in New Testament teaching, and Paul's words in particular, and this is in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, constant teaching of the Church, that we don't commit evil, even that a good may come of it.
Amen, brother. Let's go to Anonymous in Chicago, Illinois, watching on YouTube. Anonymous, thanks for watching on YouTube. What's your question for Jim Blackburn?
My question is the difference. I'm pretty confused between direct abortion and indirect abortion. I know that life starts at conception, so what's with all this indirect abortion?
Okay, that's a good question. The term indirect abortion is something that is used in different ways, and let me see if I can help clarify from a purely Catholic perspective, how we would look at that. And a direct abortion is where it is the intention of those performing a procedure to kill the embryo, kill the child, kill the baby in the womb, kill the infant. That's the intention, and it's done with that very intention. This follows very nicely on what we were just talking about, of committing evil that good may come of it. Regardless of what may come of this, the direct killing of that innocent human being for any reason is just that. It's murder. It's the intentional killing of that child. And that cannot be done, even that good may come of it. Now, we can contrast that with what is sometimes called an indirect abortion or an unintentional abortion, whereas a procedure may be done that is not the direct killing of the child, but we know that that's a likelihood of the procedure. And an example of this would be an ectopic pregnancy, where a pregnancy occurs in the fallopian tube. Well, what we cannot do in a situation like that, we know that the child is not going to develop properly in the fallopian tube. We know that that child will eventually die. We know the fallopian tube will burst and likely kill the mother as well. So what do we do? Well, what we cannot do is go in and directly kill that child in order to save the fallopian tube and the life of the mother. But what we can do is recognize that fallopian tube is now in a sense of disease, if you will, and we can remove the section of the fallopian tube. Doctors could do this. Remove that section of the fallopian tube that that is in peril at this moment and is causing peril to the life of the mother, and remove that. Now, this is seen as a procedure that is not a direct intentional killing of the child. We know that that will result, but this is it's considered a double consequence. And in moral teaching, in Catholic moral teaching, this is something that can be allowed in circumstances such as this, where you've got a good that is you've got a procedure that's not immoral of itself, this being performed for a very good reason. And even though we know that there may be an unintended consequence that's going to come about from it, we can accept that consequence in order for the good to come about. Now, a lot of times, you know, people will say, well, how is that not committing evil so that good will come out of it? And this gets right back to your question. It's the idea of direct versus indirect. This is not a direct intentional killing of the child. This is an unintended consequence. Even though it may be unavoidable, it's not what we're choosing and willing to happen. We just simply know that this is an unintended consequence of the procedure that's being done. But it can be tolerated, and I'd encourage you to go to actually Wikipedia has a good article on this. And maybe we can talk more about that after the break.
Let's do that. Let's talk a little bit about double effects and unintended consequences in the moral law when we come back on Open Forum with Jim Blackburn right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
In what forms does the Word of God come to us? How do we know that the Bible is inspired, inerrant, and complete? Why do we need tradition to help us understand Scripture? Doesn't the Bible teach that it alone is sufficient for salvation? In 20 Answers, Scripture and Tradition, you'll find smart, solid answers to these questions and many more, examining the first and most important issue in the Christian faith, the manner in which God has communicated to us the saving truths of the gospel. 20 Answers Scripture and Tradition is part of the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers, offering hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the Church and the world, all in a compact, easy-to-read package. Visit shop.catholic.com and take a look at this exciting new series from Catholic Answers Press.
Wouldn't it be great to have a book to give to anyone to explain exactly why Catholics believe what we believe? The good news is now there is. Why We're Catholic is the groundbreaking new resource by apologist Trent Horn, that one book you can hand to anyone as a starting point for helping them find their way into or back to the practice of the Catholic faith. In a series of short, easy-to-read chapters, Trent covers the whole range of common topics, starting with why we believe in anything at all and answering all the common objections to the Catholic faith, both doctrinal and moral. Don't miss out on the most important, life-changing book to come along in years. Better yet, it's only $3 a copy when you order in bulk. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
All people are called to communion with Christ in the church that he founded.
People really gravitate to David Andrews and his concern for the callers. That's not just talk. He really means it.
Tom and I are both converts. We've walked that path, and we try to walk it with the listeners at whatever stage of the journey they're on.
It's EWTN's first weekly radio-to-TV talk show. Call to Communion with Dr. David Andrews, Thursday, 1 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Television.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, Open Forum. Thanks so much for joining us this hour. Jim Blackburn is our guest. 888-318-7884 is our number. And Jim, not to cut into your time here or anything, but when Tim Staples was here, I forgot to mention this and ask him about it. Tim's speaking tonight on Mary, the Mother of God. What's all the fuss about at 6:30 p.m. Right here at O'Connor's Church Supplies in San Diego. So if you want to visit with Tim and enjoy his talk, Mary, Mother of God, What's All the Fuss About? You just get over to O'Connor's by 6:30. I know they're having refreshments there, too. And if you want more information on all these summer series talks, you can go to the Catholic Answers Facebook page, and you can get – I don't know if it's an alert, but you get a message when one of these talks is being streamed, because some of them will be streamed live around the world on the internets. So if you're in the neighborhood, stop by and enjoy Tim's talk. We were talking before we went to the break, Anonymous's question about the difference between direct and indirect abortion. You explained to him that direct abortion involves intentionally killing a child in the womb, and indirect is when a child is killed, but it's an indirect consequence of some other medical good that is trying to be achieved.
Yes, and this is the principle of double effect is what it's called in Catholic theology. And I mentioned that Wikipedia actually has a pretty decent page that explains it from a Catholic perspective. And the criteria that would justify this, what we might call an indirect abortion, are that the nature of the act that we're doing, and that would be removing a portion of the fallopian tube that is going to cause the death of the mother. Removing that must be at least a good thing, and not or morally neutral. It cannot be an evil act of itself. Yeah. Removing a diseased organ is not evil. It's not something that would be a moral evil. So we'd qualify there. The person who's doing this must intend the good that's going to come of this, and not intend, not desire, not want. As a means or ends, which would be the death of the child here. Right. And then the third thing is that, if you have death of the child here, we must have the primary end of what we are doing must be good enough, must outweigh really the danger to the child that's coming here. And of course, it's going to result in the life of the mother, maintaining the life of the mother, which is a moral good that would allow them this double consequence, even though it's unintended. So any moral theology book, or if you just want to go read about this online, go to Wikipedia and type in the principle of double effect.
And before we go to another caller, this is the same moral understanding that informs what we believe about war. And that's why we say you can't directly kill an innocent person in war. Just somebody's standing there, and maybe for a terror act or something, you decide to kill them. But it does happen that innocents are killed in war. Even we can say we know that innocents are going to be killed in war, but that has to be the consequence of another act that you didn't intend that. Even if you knew that it was going to happen, you can't have intended to kill innocent people.
That's another good application of this. In fact, any time there is going to be we do something knowing that there are going to be two effects. One is good, and that's why we're doing what we're doing. The other is bad. We don't intend it. We don't want it, but we're willing to do the good because of the good that will come of doing the good, even though this negative effect will come about as well, this negative second effect, double effect. So you can apply this to all sorts of different circumstances. You see a bus careening down a hill out of control, and there's children playing in the street. Go out and run your car into the bus to knock the bus off a cliff to save the life of the children. Sometimes this has been what you're doing is you're not intentionally killing anyone on the bus, not killing the driver of the bus. You're removing the bus, you're moving the bus out of the way of the children to save the life of the children. Or sometimes even just the idea of sacrificing your own life. You're not killing yourself. You're not committing suicide. What Jesus did on the cross for us was not suicide. Yet he was willing to do that to allow that to happen to him as a double effect, really, in a sense, of for the salvation of the world. He, we could, I might give my life for my child, run to push my child out of the way of a car careening in into my child that's going to kill my child, knowing that what I'm doing is saving my child. I know that I'm risking my own life as well, but it's not my intention to kill myself. But knowing that that could be a double effect could allow me to do that heroic act. So I hope those are some examples that might help in this situation. And all right. Again, read up on this in any Catholic theology manual or, again, Wikipedia has a nice page on it. Principle of double effect.
We go now to Sig in Remerton, Washington, listening on EWTN. Sig, your question for Jim Blackburn.
Hi, gentlemen. Can you hear me okay?
We can.
Yes.
Yeah, it flows right into my question back to the Japanese thing. My argument would be that if we wanted to just kill people, we would have bombed Tokyo. But I think that we bombed those southernmost cities because we were going to invade from the south, if at all. And I think would argue from there that the killing of people was not intended.
Mm. Oh, okay. Well, Sig, I think if you really look at the history of the choices that were made, there were no huge military targets. There were no. I mean, this was the intentional bombing of civilians. Is my understanding historically. Could more damage have been done in a more populous area like Tokyo? I suppose, but this wasn't just bombings that were intended to take out maybe a serious military target with the idea that it could be that some civilians you may be casualties in this. We don't intend that. We don't desire that. That's not my understanding of how the decisions were made in this. Catholic theology also, and you can read about this in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, the section on just war doctrine. And there are certain principles that apply, and it seems that these principles were not applied here. I'm not saying that these were Catholics making the decisions and trying to apply Catholic theology, but nonetheless, if we look at what they did, it would not meet the justification of the just war doctrine of the Catholic Church. These were immoral acts that were done with the intention of committing some evil, and it's never okay to do that. Even if we could say that it saved countless of United States military men's lives, we can't say that that's okay to have intentionally targeted and knowingly chosen to kill innocent civilians on the other side.
Can I pose to you a kind of hypothetical that might make this clearer, Jim? Let's say that sure. The Japanese themselves had a nuclear weapon, and it was in Hiroshima, and our intent was to destroy the weapon. Then you could say that's a good intent. You have a clear military objective that's reasonable and just. And if it brings casualties with it, it's something you might tolerate, but it's not an intentional evil. The case of the actual history that unfolded is all that was there, except for some small things that really wouldn't have required a nuclear weapon to attack, was a civilian population of Hiroshima. I just want to run that by you, Jim, before I get Sig's response to that. Does that seem like a reasonable kind of hypothetical to explain it?
It does. Even if there had been a large military installation of some sort that the intention was to take the lives of many, many military personnel, that even could have been something in a war situation that could have been just. It would not have been murder. It would have been choosing to, it's a measure of self-defense. And that could even tolerate the idea that some civilians might, although we're not targeting them, they're not directly choosing to kill them, that they might die in the process. That could be something that would be tolerable as a double effect. But as you mentioned, Sai, neither one of these was the case. We weren't taking out a nuclear weapons facility. We weren't taking out a huge military facility. This was intentionally doing damage and committing some evil here. So yeah, let Sig come back on that.
Well, yeah, Sig, well, we got to take a break pretty soon. But what's your response to that? How does that sit with you?
Well, and then there's military technology too. Would it have been really possible to, at that point in the war, for us to fly planes in there at a low altitude to do pinpoint bombing and without 80% chance of getting us shot down and not getting the job done, you know?
Yeah, without doubt, Sig. And thank you very much for that call. We do have to take a break. But again, I just want to repeat the fundamental principle here is even given all that, you can't do a direct evil act, commit an evil in order to get a good result, even if it's to save the lives of your own soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and Coast Guardies, and all that, you can't. You just can't directly attack innocent civilians. We'll be right back with more on Catholic Answers Live.
We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
What is the Catholic form of marriage and why is it important? What factors may invalidate a marriage? What about the so-called exception clause for divorce in cases of adultery? In 20 Answers, Divorce and Remarriage, you'll find smart, solid answers to these questions and many more, helping you understand church teaching on the indissolubility of marriage while examining the pastoral and canonical realities for Catholics who wish to join together in marriage. 20 Answers Divorce and Remarriage is part of the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers, offering hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the Church and the world, all in a compact, easy-to-read package. Visit shop.catholic.com today and take a look at this exciting new series from Catholic Answers Press.
Homeschool Connections has recently formed a partnership featuring a dual enrollment program with Franciscan University of Steubenville. Our website is homeschoolconnections.com. We are a proud sponsor of Catholic Answers Live.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In Matthew 7:12, Jesus said to his disciples, "Do to others whatever you would have them do to you. This is the law and the prophets." We're all familiar with this golden rule, as it has come to be called. It's an easy one to understand. It does require that we at least theoretically consider the other person's situation. To do this requires that we acknowledge the other person to be worth at least as much as ourselves. I say at least because if we truly love the other person, we may find ourselves putting his welfare way above our own. Parents often do this for their children. Our Blessed Lord certainly did this for us. It's the way of love. So, as I broadcast these words to you through your receiving device, know that I consciously try to keep you in mind as I speak them. I consider you worth the effort, but more importantly, so does the Lord. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back. Final segment of Open Forum today on Catholic Answers Live. A lot of talk about war and peace today. A lot of talk about tough moral issues. We go now to, and maybe we'll see. Let's see if James has something that takes us off of this. We've made you do some tough moral thinking, I think, Jim Blackburn.
Okay. Well, that's what I'm here for. So let's give it a try.
You are the mellowest guy. You just take everything. You just roll with it. All right. James in Detroit, Michigan, listening on 89.9 FM. Your question for Jim Blackburn.
Can you hear me?
Okay. We can.
Yes, sir.
I was just wondering what, if you could tell me what the significance of the temple veil being torn when Christ was crucified.
You sure you want that to be your question? You don't want to ask something about nuclear war or maybe biological war? You got nothing? Okay. All right. We're going to go with that question. Go ahead,
okay.
Jim.
Well, okay, James, there's lots of symbolism here. I mean, we know historically that this happened. When Jesus died, very many different things did happen, but this is one of them. What do we make of this? One of the, and there, by the way, isn't just one definitive answer of, you know, this is why it happened and what it means. There have been speculations by theologians, church fathers, and such down through history, and the church doesn't just have a single teaching on this. But what are some of the theological aspects of the veil being split at Jesus' death? One thing that theologians look at is what was the purpose of the veil? What was it there for? And, you know, it separated parts of the temple, the Holy of Holies, from the outer part there. And the separation of this, of the veil, the tearing of the veil, would then open up the Holy of Holies, the holiest place in the temple, open that up. And that would now be accessible to anyone, not just those who at certain times had the authority to to be on the other side of it in the Holy of Holies. Now, with the veil being torn, heaven, in a sense, if we look at the temple as a microcosm of the universe, as theologians look at it and see that the Holy of Holies is the residence of God, it's heaven, in a sense, the gates of heaven have been opened. Jesus dies on the cross for the forgiveness of our sins, and now heaven has been opened to us. We know from Peter's epistles that Jesus goes during his time in the tomb, he preaches to the souls in hell or in the abode of the dead who are awaiting the opening of the gates of heaven, and Jesus accomplishes that for them. So that's one of the aspects of it. Another one that's commonly applied here is the fact that Jesus that the temple was used for the Judaic sacrifices, for the Mosaic sacrifices. The laws of Judaism that were in place required this veil, and certain sacrifices, certain rituals were performed. And by the tearing of this veil, that covenant then has come to an end, and the new covenant through Christ has now been instituted. And so we don't need the temple anymore. We now have Christ. We have the sacraments. We have the church that he has ushered in here. That's another aspect of it. And there are many. I would encourage you, if you want to read more, James, go to Catholic.com and type in temple veil or tearing, something like that. There have been multiple articles and Q&As done on this, and you'll find a lot of interesting responses to it. And I hope you'll be open to multiple understandings. When we see things like this happen in Scripture, we want to see how rich they are in meaning, and not just limit ourselves to one particular understanding, but be open to the beauty that that God gives us through this and the various different meanings that we can glean from it. Okay?
Okay.
Thank you, James.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, James. We go now to Cora in Dallas, Texas, listening to EWTN on 910 AM. Cora, your question for Jim Blackburn.
Hi.
Hi.
Are you there?
We are.
Okay, hi. Thank you. I'm a first-time caller. And I'm really happy to be on the air. And thank you for all you do. My question is, my mother-in-law and my father-in-law are deceased, and their ashes are commingled in an urn. We bought a house, and my husband built a little memorial site in the backyard, so we had our local preacher from our church come and bless our home.
Okay.
And we asked him if he can please bless the memorial site, and he said he could not do that. I want to know why.
Okay. Cora, I can't get into the mind of the priest, but I can try to figure this out. And I would suspect that he is recognizing that what has been done with the commingling of the ashes into an urn and buried in a place in the yard is not the proper disposition of the human remains of your in-laws, I think you said. And the Catholic Church would like to see those remains. These are human remains, and they should be treated with a certain dignity and a certain reverence. And burying them in the backyard is not considered that to rise to that level of dignity and reverence for the human remains. So what I would encourage you to do is to exhume those or have someone come out and do this for you, maybe from the funeral home. Exhume those and then take them to a proper Catholic cemetery and have them interred there. And I suspect that the priest would desire as well that you do that, that instead of blessing what's happened and trying to say that that's okay, he probably wants to encourage you to do what the church would have you do with these human remains and have them interred in a in a proper place that's fitting of the dignity of human remains and the reverence due to these human beings whose remains we're handling here. So, Corey, that would be my take on it. I would ask you to talk to the priest again and ask him, is this what you're suggesting that we do? And he could probably help you find a Catholic cemetery. He could help you find a Catholic funeral home that could handle this in a reverent, dignified way for you.
And I think he did mention something to that effect.
But okay.
I think the cost, and I've talked to other people, the cost, I mean, it would be thousands of dollars for us to get, you know, the burial site, the cemetery plot, or because their ashes are commingled. Is that going to...
I don't think that's going to be a major aspect of it, no. In fact, once they're mingled, you're not going to be able to unmingle them anyway. But what you can do is take the remains that have been mingled, and if the financial situation is preventing you from doing this, I suspect that the priest and the funeral home and they could minimize the costs for you in this case, because... there's kind of been an injustice done here. To the, you know, these remains have not been treated as they should. I'm not trying to say that you've intentionally committed an evil or something like that, or that you've sinned. No, you didn't know what the situation was. But now that you recognize that this is a situation that shouldn't exist as it does, I would encourage you to. You try, even as you can afford, you know, what you can apply that to this, and I suspect the priest and the funeral home may be able to help out with some of those costs as well, just to get the situation rectified for the dignity and the reverence of those remains.
Cora,
we were fulfilling my in-laws' wishes. They wanted their ashes commingled, you know.
Mm-hmm. Like I say, I don't think the commingling is the primary concern here, if it's a concern at all. I think the concern is the disposition. What's been done, a code of canon law ordinarily requires that Catholic that we bury our relatives in a Catholic cemetery if possible, and that any human remains be treated reverently and with dignity. And that's going to, you know, even the sprinkling of ashes is something that the church does not currently see as being something that's reverent. Burying them in something other than a cemetery or even a Catholic cemetery, preferably, is something the church just doesn't see as the reverence that's due to the human remains. You know, we look forward to the resurrection of the body, and these are the human remains, the remains of these people's bodies, and we need to recognize they're going to have their bodies again at some point. And this is what we want to do, is treat these remains with reverence and have them disposed of properly or interred properly. Okay, Cora? And again, I think if finances are a problem, you know, everybody has a GoFundMe page for funerals and things like this these days. That might be an option. Talk to the priest about options.
Definitely talk to a Catholic cemetery as well. Catholic cemeteries, yes, are ministries. They're not just businesses. They're ministries, usually of the diocese, but sometimes of an order or of a parish. And ask them for help, because if they have the resources, they will help you.
Thank you so much.
Church is here to help.
Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you so much, Cora.
Thank you
very much for that call. And if I may add, Jim, one other advantage of being buried in a Catholic cemetery: Mass celebrated at these cemeteries very sometimes daily in some places, but very frequently in all of them. And they pray for the souls of the dead. That's nothing to sneeze at.
It's not. And imagine going, you know, having... missing out on that. Well, let's get these remains buried properly and take advantage of all of that. The blessed Catholic cemetery plot, all these kinds of things can only help. And so I hope Cora will talk to a priest about that.
All right. Thank you very much, Jim Blackburn. It was a pleasure spending that hour with you.
Thank you, Cy. God bless.
I'm going to have better jokes next time.
Okay.
And before we go, I just want to say thanks to my wife for giving birth to our daughter 21 years ago today. And I want to say to my daughter, Sophie, take it easy, kid. Just take it easy. All right. See you next time on Catholic Answers Live.